Shri Asha Upanishads Ki Jai. So we got started a little later today. What time is it now? In the 7? And we go till 8 o'clock? Is that right? Okay. We could read. Last week we read verse 9, so today we'll read verse 10 and the purport. Who remembers without looking? Verse 9. Got the microphone? Because you're on camera.
I'm just taking a shot here.
Okay, take
those who worship the demigods shall enter into the darkest region of ignorance. Worse still so are those who worship the impersonal Brahman.
I think you got 100 points. You hit the mark. And there's no loss in spiritual life. Let's just check, just to make sure. Those who engage in the culture of nescient activity shall enter the darkest region of ignorance. And worse still are those who engage in the culture of so-called knowledge. So just a little bit off. Nescient activities. What's an example of a nescient activity? That should be easy. Let's use the mics because we want to include the rest of the world in our discussion. So going to work, no, that's nuts.
Doing anything with the sense of enjoyment for yourself. Mm.
So it's really, it's more than the activity, it's the consciousness behind it. Huh? So if we're doing some activity thinking we're the doer, right there, that's nescient, right? There's some lack of light there. There's no light, there's darkness. So thinking we're the doer. But grossly speaking, just breaking the four regulator principles, which is the foundation of sinful life. I just got a letter from one woman in Japan, and she was she's new to Krishna consciousness, and she's just learning about the four regulative principles. And she wanted to write her realizations about the four regulative principles. And she says that since she started following the four regulative principles, she said her whole life is much freer. And Krishna, he also says that in the Bhagavad Gita. He calls, when you begin to control your senses, he calls that the regulative principles of freedom. So it's the beginning of getting free of nescient, that darkness. And getting free of the conception that we're separate from Krishna and that we're the doer.
Pursuing education which is not related to Krishna consciousness.
So that would be the cultivation of knowledge, huh? That's the other part, so-called knowledge. Yeah. So can you give an example of how that kind of, it looks like we're learning something, but in the end, it causes us to be more in ignorance?
I was just at work, just coming off fresh, and some people, they are very highly qualified, and they think that they know everything. And so we were part of a hiring panel where they were interviewing some other person. And there were like 50-50 oaths, like some people said he's okay and three people says no. And there was one person who was like in a higher position and he thought that he knows everything. And they come and they give the decision and they said like, if you see there is one person who says no, it means a no. And you can see that how becoming puffed up with higher education, thinking that you know more about a person, not considering the humane aspect, they forget that the other person is a soul. Like They just think that it's all intellectual. And I felt that that person was in complete ignorance than the person who came. So this knowledge, acquiring knowledge, actually makes you go farther and farther away from Krishna.
And it feeds the false ego?
Yeah, yeah.
Can that happen to devotees as well?
Many times. Yeah.
It's very difficult to get out of it. But I just want to say one comment for the callers on the phone, that you can speak at any time by unmuting your phone. Press *6 to unmute your phone. And then after you have spoken, press *6 again to mute.
Thank you for sharing that. So knowledge, even spiritual knowledge, the symptom of one who's in knowledge is that he has humility, right? Actually, that's the first quality Krishna talks about. Maybe we'll get to it tonight in the 13th chapter. That's actually the verse we're on. Krishna's talking about the path of knowledge and the qualities that you have to cultivate in order to realize the knowledge. And the first quality he mentions is humility. So we can read this spiritual knowledge and then we can hit somebody over the head with it, you know. I know more than you and you don't know anything. And and all the time, you know, we're steeped in ignorance, even though we're maybe parroting the knowledge. Of course, not that we shouldn't learn this knowledge, but it's just the consciousness behind it. So if we're not cultivating humility while we study this knowledge, then it can also be a cause of an anartha developing in our heart and blocking the light. I just want you to relate one experience I had. I don't know if I can convey to you the shock that I felt, but I remember when I was distributing books in Japan many years ago, and I used to go to this place called Ginza, which is the famous shopping area, and it's a really expensive place. And Sony, it probably still does. Sony was just beginning in those days. It was a new company, and it wasn't really big and powerful like it is now. But they had one building in Ginza, and I always used to stand in front of the Sony store and distribute. And many foreigners used to come there for shopping. And I remember I met this one American man in a wheelchair, and he was an angry old man, you know. And kind of really puffed up, and he told me, he actually told me in a very way full of pride, he said, you know, I helped develop the atom bomb, you know, and he was so proud of that. And I was thinking, oh, this guy is so ignorant. Imagine the karma he's got coming. So here is knowledge, you know, used, and Krishna says that the demons, they develop things meant to destroy the world. They don't know what is good, what is not. They can't distinguish between good and bad. And so, knowledge is sort of like a tool, like a hammer. You know, you can use it to beat a nail, or you can use it to beat somebody over the head. And so knowledge is like that. So even spiritual knowledge or so-called knowledge, if the proper consciousness, if the humility is not there, or the proper intention is not there behind it, then it becomes an ignorant thing. It appears, you know, illuminating, but in the end it causes our darkness, causes more darkness. Well, that's what the Upanishads are saying, and Krishna says the same thing in Bhagavad Gita. So let's read mantra 10. So, anyad evahora vidyaya, nyad ahura vidyaya, iti shushruma dhiranam, yenastad vidyachakshare. Anyat, different, eva, certainly, ahu, said, vidyaya, by culture of knowledge, anyat, different, ahu, said, avidyaya, by culture of nescience, Iti, thus, Shushruma, I heard, Dhyaranam, from the sober, yea, who, na, to us, taught that, Vichachakshare, explained. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada. The wise have explained that one result is derived from the culture of knowledge, and that a different result is obtained from the culture of nescience. So purport. So let's take turns reading the purport, and maybe we can all read a few paragraphs. Why don't you begin, Mataji? Maybe you can read up to. Actually, Prabhupada here is going. He's going to quote from the 13th chapter on the verse we're on. So this matches super well here. Okay.
As advised in chapter 13 of the Bhagavad Gita, 13.8-12, one should culture knowledge in the following way. One should become a perfect gentleman and learn to give proper respect to others. Two, one should not pose himself as a religionist simply for the name and fame. Three, one should not become a source of anxiety to others by the actions of his body, by the thoughts of his mind, or by his words. Four, one should learn forbearance even in the face of provocation from others. 5. One should learn to avoid duplicity in his dealings with others. 6. One should search out a bona fide spiritual master who can lead him gradually to the stage of spiritual realization, and one must submit himself to such a spiritual master, render him service, and ask relevant questions. 7. In order to approach the platform of self-realization, one must follow the regulative principles enjoined in the revealed scriptures. 8. One must be fixed in the tenets of the revealed scriptures. 9. One should completely refrain from practices which are detrimental to the interest of self-realization.
10. One should not accept more than he requires for the maintenance of the body. 11. One should not falsely identify himself with the gross material body, nor should one consider those who are related to this body to be his own. 12. One should always remember that as long as he has a material body, he must face the miseries of repeated birth, old age, disease, and death. There is no use in making plans to get rid of these miseries of the material body. The best course is to find out the means by which one may regain his spiritual identity. 13. One should not be attached to more than the necessities of life required for spiritual advancement. 14. One should not be more attached to wife, children, and home than the revealed scriptures ordain. 15. One should not be happy or distressed over desirables and undesirables, knowing that such feelings are just created by the mind. 16. One should become an unalloyed devotee of the personality of Godhead Shri Krishna and serve him with rapt attention. 17. One should develop a liking for residence in a secluded place with a calm and quiet atmosphere favorable for spiritual culture, and one should avoid congested places where non-devotees congregate. One should become a scientist or philosopher and conduct research into spiritual knowledge, recognizing that spiritual knowledge is permanent, whereas material knowledge ends with the death of the body.
Wow. So, it's interesting because Prabhupada mentions these 18 items in his purport to this verse in the 13th chapter, and the phraseology is just a little bit different, isn't it?
Regarding the 18th statement, recognizing that the spiritual knowledge is permanent, whereas material knowledge ends with the death of body. But isn't it true that if one has got material knowledge, for example, one has become a mathematician, that's a material knowledge, and in the next birth, he tends to be attracted to mathematics. That's not true? Or because he had that tendency in the previous life.
Well, there's no guarantees. And that's a possibility. Just like we see somebody in this life who's already, you know, some children, they know higher math at a very young age, or, you know, they know music, or, you know, these little opera stars. And but that's no guarantee, because if you're in the bodily concept of life, you know, at the time of death, whatever you're most attracted to, and if you happen to, you know, during your life cultivate a mode of ignorance at the same time, it's possible you could even slip down to So no guarantees. And besides, even if you do know it, you still have to kind of learn it all over again, don't you? Even if it may be easier for you because you studied in your last life than somebody else.
I was also thinking that along the lines of guarantee, it's Krishna who brings the remembrance from within us. So if you, if within the same family, some children are very quick at grasping things, and where the sibling will have a tough time trying to understand, or even in a class, some students, the teacher speaks only once and they understand and they remember, and others are struggling. So I'm kind of just thinking that it could be that they did do that in their previous birth, and now Krishna, but still is making them remember. So ultimately, it's Krishna who does it, like he did it for Bharat, Maharaja Bharat, you know. So yeah, that he remembered his last birth.
So there's so many.
Like you said, that, you know, there's no guarantee though. So I guess the guarantee comes from, you know, how much Krishna is interested in giving that to you.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're cultivating knowledge, and your goal is just to be comfortable and enjoy the body, that's the same as an animal. There's really no difference, and also you're on your own. And so the results are almost mechanical, because it's really not you. It's just the modes of nature. It's just you're following a particular program, a recipe of the material world, and unconsciously, practically. And so the results are just going to be some mechanical pattern of the modes of material nature. But if you're surrendered to Krishna, then he's going to, you know, protect what you have and preserve what you have, and give what you're lacking, and make it an arrangement in such a way that you'll come back to him. Hare Bol, Akshay Prabhu.
So I'm kind of just thinking aloud over here as to what we gain, like you go to the universities and you gain material knowledge, the laws of physics or chemistry, equations and things like that. And how does that compare to the samskaras that we form? Because samskaras do go from one birth to another birth, right?
Well, everything we're experiencing in life is a samskara. It's making an impression, and we know that. I know my when I was going through my training, I had to spend a certain amount of time in the operating room, learning how to put tubes into people's tracheas, and that would begin the operation. I'd begin the operation with the anesthesiologist, and then I would just stay for the operation sometimes and watch. And one operation I was in on was that wasn't really an intubation. I mean, but it was just, I was just starting the IVs, but I got to stay, and it was a brain operation. And you know, they have to, they remove the top of the skull, and then the patient is awake. And because they have to map out the brain, and not everyone's brain's the same, so they stimulate parts of the brain and they talk to the patient to find out, you know, if they're in the right spot. And sometimes when they stimulate the brain, it triggers memories, some sanskars, right, that are there. And I remember this one lady was recalling when she was, you know, at her 3-year-old birthday party, and she was describing minute detail of the fringe dress that she was wearing, and, you know, just all the stuff was coming up. So normally we can't access it, but it's all there. Everything that we've heard, everything that we've seen, everything that we've tasted, everything that we smelled, makes, you know, the mind takes a picture of it and files it away. And that's there from every birth. That subtle body, you know, is carrying us to the next gross body, carrying, you know, the soul's the driving force behind it. But so that's all sanskar. So what we want to do is make spiritual samskars, you know, and the spiritual samskars are much more powerful than the material samskars. But there's, you know, there's kind of like this fight amongst the samskars going on within us, and, you know, you never know what's gonna come up next, right? Do you know what your next thought's gonna be? No, nobody does. And your next thought's gonna be whatever samskar is gonna be stimulated, you know, either stimulated by the environment or just happen to pop up.
Usually when we go on book distribution, if somebody to ask somebody to take a book, we used to say that this knowledge is permanent, and we used to quote an example that even if you are an Albert Einstein, next birth you take, you have to learn your ABCs. So is that a right statement to make, or is it is actually deceiving them?
Well, what does Krishna say about what you gain in spiritual life? About the endeavors you make as a yogi? Krishna says in the second chapter, you know, the 40th verse, he says, Neha Vikramanasosti, right? Do you know that verse?
Neha Vikramanasosti Pratyavayuna Vidyate Svalpamapyasa Dharmasya Trayate Mahatobhayan. So even a little endeavor that is made on the spiritual path will help you overcome greatest danger.
Well, says, Neha Vikramanasosti Pratyavayo Navidyate Svalpam Apyasha Dharmasha Trayate Mahatobhayan. So he says, just a little advancement on this path, whatever advancement you've made, it doesn't decrease. Mm-hmm. There's no decrease and there's no loss. So if there's no decrease and there's no loss, then in your next life, that spiritual knowledge, that much perception or that level of awareness you have, and you're not going to lose that, and you can never lose it. So ultimately, you know, when you have enough in your spiritual bank account, all the lights go on and you go back to Godhead.
But the other side about the Einstein, is it a correct statement?
Well, from the material side, we don't know, you know. But from the spiritual side, and even Einstein, you know, these very, very gifted people, you know, they're getting the grace of the Lord as well. As Shraddha Devi Dasi was saying, that Krishna is the source of remembering and forgetting. So everything is by Krishna's mercy, our forgetting and our remembering. But, if you've engaged in spiritual activity, are you really, according to that verse, are you guaranteed a human birth? Because he says, you know, it protects from the greatest fear. So the greatest fear is not having an opportunity or to fall down to the lower species. So I think yes and no. Yes, it's true that whatever you cultivate spiritually, you're not gonna lose, and you're going to continue on in your next life, and it's guaranteed your next life is at least a human birth. But if just from the material point of view, no, you can't say there's any guarantees.
Isn't there a role for the subtle body as the record of all activity, that one is carrying the subtle body with from birth to birth.
Yeah.
And your karmic record is there, apparently. So if your karmic record is there, then you would think that that record of your actions and reactions and things, however you acted in this life, would be there. And so that is carried over. And that's, question to ask whether in that karmic record, in that subtle body, would also be the knowledge that one has had and all those things. There is, of course, some suggestion by Krishna in the 15th chapter. He says that whatever conceptions you have in this world, I will give you a body commensurate with that. It's like a carryover. And I've heard about this. I wouldn't know what shastra to cite, but the subtle body plays some role in carrying of a record from one life to the other. So the question would be whether in that subtle body would be retained some knowledge, advancements, or whatever that could get played out in the next life.
Well, everything is there in the subtle body. It's all recorded. All the impressions are there. And the gross body is just a result of the subtle body. It's everything's really revolving around the subtle body. Even the actions and reactions, they begin with a thought. You know, and we have a thought becomes a desire and then it becomes an action. So they're not really separate. You know, they all go together. But ultimately all the actions, you know, are depending upon the desire behind them.
So when you cited that operation where people were doing something to the brain and that triggered a lot of memories, but all that memories actually reside in the mind or in the subtle body. Now, where is the mind? Like, I always grew up thinking the mind is here until we read in the Bhagavatam that day that the mind is in the heart. And so...
Also, the mind is made of the mode of goodness, pure goodness. A lot of people think, oh, the mind must be made of mode of passion. No? But the mind is really, it's just a vessel. It's a pure mode of goodness vessel that it's not bad or good. It's really not. We talk about it like it's our friend or our enemy, but it really, it's just a place that holds the thoughts. It's the back screen that the movie is playing on. Right? And so, you know, all the thoughts we have that are in the different modes of nature are there. And in the yoga language, the mind is called the citta. So it's a receptacle and it has all the impressions. It holds all the impressions. But itself is actually pure in the mode of goodness. But the contents is where we have the problem. You know, it's like the problem is not really with the cup. The problem is what we hold in the cup. Yeah. So those, you know, if we're having passionate thoughts, you know, so the false ego is born out of the motive of ignorance. But the mind is born out of the motive of goodness. You know, when it talks about, in the Bhagavatam, especially in the third canto, talks about how the material world is created from subtle to gross. And so, and also the mind is not material, right? So we try and think of it as in a particular location or, you know, it's in the heart, but in reality, you know, the mind is a body in itself, right? And actually it's associated with the chakra just above the navel. And it has an energy that goes out, you know, that goes way out. And it's pretty much in the mode of goodness. But the thoughts that come in, all the samskaras that are contained with it, whatever we focus our attention on, the consciousness, because the consciousness is just the focusing aspect of awareness or perception, pure perception. Right? So whatever we focus on, that becomes magnified and that becomes our experience. Yeah. So it's not, the mind is just the screen, and then all the samskaras are being flashed on the screen, and the consciousness, the soul, is just sitting in the audience looking at all this, focusing on it, and whatever it focuses on, that's what it experiences. And so that's what's going from body to body. And the mind is just a subtle body. So we have, you know, in yoga language, we have our gross body. And the gross body is being maintained by the etheric body, which is this. It's the energy that connects the subtle to the gross. So at the very base of the spine is the energy center there of the etheric body, and that's connected to the earth. All of these energy centers are connected to material elements, and they also control the senses. So the very base chakra, that's earth stability, and it energizes the gross cells, the prana of this, and then the next one is just below the navel, and that's associated with water and emotion and sexuality. And then above the navel is kind of the energy holder, which is the mind. And it's all the pictures are there. There's not so much emotion there, but just all the samskaras, all the pictures. Then higher up you come to the heart center, and that's associated with, actually, the solar plexus center, that's the mind, and the mind body goes out. It goes out further than the gross body, and it goes out further than the emotional body. Each one is within the other. It's kind of like you have these little, you ever seen those little containers? You have one container inside another container inside another container, and you have the little tiny container inside. So the gross body is the smallest container. And then you have the next container and the next container, and then you have the mind container. And then you have the heart container, which is also associated with air and also with the ability to love and receive love, openness of heart. We say, oh, his heart's closed, he can't talk, you know. Or, you know, when we get angry, then the heart closes and we feel this tightness and there's no flow there. And then you have the throat, which is associated with speech and sound and ether. All right? Without space, there's no ether. So this is all described in the third canto. And then above that, you have the brow chakra, which actually is also associated with mind, but it's much more than that. And it contains all the other bodies. And it's the central point where all sense information comes in and all thoughts and everything are viewed. It's like the viewing station for the Atma, for the soul. And then above that is the crown chakra, which is the pure consciousness, kind of half in and half out. And all these are different bodies. That's the biggest body. So the mental body is sort of in the middle. And then the consciousness is because of the awareness, because of that energy, all these other bodies can operate. Just like the gross body can also operate because of the spiritual body that's there. And without the spiritual body, none of these gross bodies, subtle bodies, none of them have any energy. They're all made of the Bhumarapandalovayu, Kamanobudhaevacha, the eight material energies. They don't have any consciousness. They don't have any self-awareness themselves.
So these bodies that extend beyond the gross bodies, how do you relate that to the term aura that is used? Is aura the sum total of all these?
Yeah, they all have an aura. They all have a color. And some people can see them. And sometimes you can almost feel them, like if somebody's really, really angry. If two people were having a heavy argument, right, and suddenly you open the door and they become quiet, right? But you can sense the energy of anger in the room, right? Yeah. Without thinking about it, your initial reaction will be, wow, what's going on here? Something bad's happening, you know? Or just the opposite. So we do have this perception to a certain degree. Yeah. So those are the auras. And that's what is carrying one to the next body. And the next body is simply going to fit like a glove into the glove, you know. So these subtle bodies are like a glove, and then the hand goes in. So it's just the last part. So this gross body is just, and even the gross body is, it's just energy. It's material energy. But it's also, even though it appears very gross, it's, relatively speaking, it also has a lot of space, right? Just like we know, if you look at the atom, like this body is just a combination of atoms, and atoms make molecules, and there's actually a lot of space between atoms, and even within the atom, I've heard that the distance between the electron and the proton is further away, relatively speaking, than the Earth is from the Sun. And so if you take an electron microscope and you start to look at these things, you start to see the spaciousness that is there, even within the material energy. So, and all energy is vibrating. And so the gross material body is actually, it's vibrating energy of light, but it's vibrating at a very, very slow rate. And the etherical body is vibrating at a higher rate. And then the emotional body is vibrating at a higher rate than that, mental body higher rate than that. And each successive body is more subtle and higher vibration. And then the thoughts that we have, that we put into the mind, they also vibrate at different frequencies, right? So if you have, maybe very thick, muddy-looking, substance in here, you could compare that to grief or anger, And then pure water might be joy. And so whatever we're holding in the container of the mind, that will determine what our experience is. And so the mind is really not the problem. The problem is what we choose to hold in the mind and our identification with the contents in the mind. And so that's why bhakti yoga is so incredibly powerful, because all the samskaras that we're creating in bhakti yoga, is everything spiritualized and has a spiritualized vibration, and that's all being, it's filling up our cups all the time. Every offering that we smell, every time we touch the ghee lamp, every time we look at the deities, every time we chant the Hare Krishna mantra, we're purging out all those, it's cheto, dharpana, marginam. This is because the mind is just reflective, and it's a pure instrument for reflecting the soul. As long as there's no crud in the way, it will give a perfect reflection back of the soul. And that's what it's for. And so the Hare Krishna mantra and all our spiritual activities there, cleansing the mind, they're replacing all the perverted, you know, sanskaras. And then the spiritual sanskaras, they're still, you know, and they're also pure, so they don't distort the reflection of the soul. I don't know how we got onto this topic.
Because the question was raised about aura, and you gave a very excellent discussion about the mind getting purified and now reflecting the soul. And so that reflection is going to be very luminous, if you will, you can. And so you can ask whether aura is really a measure of that, that it is reflecting the spiritual samskaras that you mentioned. They said that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had a lot of aura and effulgence about himself, about him, that people can see. What is that? He's so spiritually advanced. He's like a pure soul. So he's really reflecting it to a certain degree. Just an example. And we see people, we see different people. You can make out they have a certain aura, effulgence about them. And it's possibly reflects their higher level of spiritual advancement. It just naturally shows. One can ask if that is due to the mirror of the mind reflecting the purity that you were talking about, the spiritual samskaras.
Yeah. I mean, we notice this on a subtle level. And it also can be conversely, the converse can also be true, that when somebody is very angry or very, very deranged or very intoxicated, then their aura is very dim or dark. You know, and sometimes they refer to somebody as a very dark countenance, you know, or a very bright countenance. So yeah, it comes out even in the gross body there, you know, in the eyes and in the shine. What I wanted to do was actually maybe not finish this purport, but I'd like to read Prabhupada's phrasing of these aspects in the Bhagavad Gita and just compare the two, Hare Krishna. And also remember, this is so in the Bhagavad Gita we'll be looking at 13 between verses 12 and between verses 8 and 12. In chapter 13, 572. So I'd like to read these, read the verse again and just see in the verse compared to, I'd like to go back and forth for each one of these and just see the difference in the phraseology and discuss each one of these maybe in a little bit more detail. But before I do that, I just wanted to bring us back to the point from the very beginning. The reason why is Krishna talking about the aspects of knowledge here? It's because Arjuna asked him the question. He asked him about six or seven different things. On page 564, Arjuna said, "My dear Krishna, I wish to know about prakriti, nature, which we were just discussing. Purusha, the enjoyer." So sometimes the Purusha in yoga language too is also referred to as the Atma or the soul. And Prakriti is referring to the unconscious material energy, which even the mind and the intelligence and the false ego are all unconscious material energy. So they're called Prakriti, and the Atma or the soul is called the Purusha. So I wish to know about Prakriti, the Purusha, the field, and the knower of the field, and of knowledge and of the object of knowledge. So Arjuna wants to know what is knowledge, and he wants to know what's the object of knowledge. So he wants to know six things. He wants to know what is nature, what is the Purusha, the enjoyer, What is the field? What is the knower of the field? So that's four things. What is knowledge? What is the object of knowledge? So he wants to know six things. So in this, then in the very first answer, the very first reply, Krishna explains to him three things. He explains to him, O son of Kunti, the body is called the field. So the field is the body. So that's answer number one. And one who knows this body is called the knower. So the knower, that's the Purusha. And then in verse 3 he says, one who understands the knower, one should understand also that I am the knower in all bodies, and to understand this body and its knower is called knowledge. So there he defines knowledge as one who knows the knower, not only the knower of this body, but the knower in all bodies, and knows the difference between the two. He says that's knowledge. Huh?
So one who knows the knower and the, what is the other one between two means?
One who knows the knower and the body and the difference between them. That is knowledge. That's Krishna's definition of knowledge. So in verses 8 through 12, he's explaining to us how you come to know that. How do you come to know that you're the knower and not the body? How do you get that knowledge? You know, first he's defined what it is. Knowledge is to know the difference between the two. Now, how does that come about? That's explained in verse 8 through 12. So I just wanted to read along with Isha Upanishad. Just read each one. Read from the Bhagavad Gita and then read number one in Isha Upanishad, then read number two. So in number one, so if we look at Isha Upanishad on page 69, we find number one. And in the Bhagavad Gita, we find the first quality, humility. Right? So humility, and then Prabhupada's phraseology of humility in the Isha Upanishad is, one should become a perfect gentleman and learn to give proper respect to others. So that's his definition of humility in Isha Upanishad. Then we have pridelessness. So that would be number two in the Isha Upanishad. One should not pose himself as a religionist simply for name and fame. And we can see, you know, that if you get this knowledge, you can become proud. We were talking about that. And then that can be another cause of ignorance. Instead of becoming the cause of knowledge, spiritual knowledge can be the cause of your ignorance or pride. And then number three is nonviolence in the Bhagavad Gita and in the Isha Upanishad. One should not become a source of anxiety to others by the actions of his body, by the thoughts of his mind, or by his words. So nonviolence to others in mind, body, and words. Then number four is tolerance in the Bhagavad Gita. And in the Isha Upanishad we have, one should learn forbearance even in the face of provocation from others. And then number five in the Bhagavad Gita is simplicity. And five in the Isha Upanishad is, one should learn to avoid duplicity in his dealings with others. So that's being very simple. Just being straightforward and not having an agenda, not calculating. If I say this and do that, then he's going to react like this or like that, and the number six would be approaching a bona fide spiritual master. And in the Ishopanishad, it says, Prabhupada says, one should search out a bona fide spiritual master who can lead him gradually to the stage of spiritual realization. One must submit himself to such a spiritual master, render him service, and ask relevant questions. So basically Prabhupada is almost verbatim quoting from Bhagavad Gita, chapter 4, verse 36 or 37, Tadvidi prani pratena pari prasnena sevaya upadekshati te ganam ganina stava darshina. So number 7, we have cleanliness. And in Ishopanishad, Prabhupada says, in order to approach the platform of self-realization, one must follow the regulated principles enjoined in the revealed scriptures. So Prabhupada's equating cleanliness to following the four regulated principles. In other words, if you don't follow the four regulated principles, then you'll be unclean in body and mind. And number 8 would be steadiness. In 8 in the Ishopanishad, one must be fixed in the tenets of the revealed scriptures. Wow, that's interesting. So we can be very, very up and down in our spiritual practice, and this is actually a stage of unsteadiness, but Prabhupada appears to be saying here that by having a grounding in spiritual knowledge and the shastras, and this would contribute to our steadiness in spiritual practice. In other words, we should know why we're doing what we're doing while we're doing it. So 9, self-control. Actually, would anybody else like to read some of these? Maybe we should go around the room. Who has a microphone? We'll start with... You have a microphone? Would you like to start with number 9? Can you read from the Bhagavad Gita and then read from Ishopanishad?
Okay, so...
9 would be...
Renunciation, is it?
Self-control.
Oh, self-control. In the Ishopanishad, it says one should completely refrain from practices which are detrimental to the interest of self-realization.
Mm. It's funny, almost all of these you can relate to some verse in the Shastra. This would be being related to the aspects of surrender. One should reject what is unfavorable for devotional service. Prabhupada would equate that to self-control. So it's Rupa Goswami explains that in the Nectar of Instruction. Okay, so 10.
Number 10, renunciation of objects of sense gratification. One should not accept more than he requires for the maintenance of the body. Hmm.
And then we have 11, huh? Which would be absence of false ego.
One should not falsely identify himself with the gross material world.
One should not falsely identify himself with the gross material body.
Nor should one consider those who are related to his body to be his own.
Mm. That sounds easy, huh? But you can see, though, this would lead one to the actual perception of seeing that you're the knower, that you're the perceiver, and not the field. So as long as we're thinking, I'm this body, and that all my relatives are mine or related to this body, then we're not, then we're thinking we are the field. So that's the opposite of knowledge. And so by cultivating this awareness, we come to the awareness that we are the awareness and we're not what we're aware of. Right? So let's see, where are we now? Number 12? 12. 12 in the Bhagavad Gita.
the perception of the evil of birth, death, old age, and disease.
Mm-hmm.
In Isopanishad it says, one should always remember that as long as he has a material body, he must face the miseries of repeated birth, old age, disease, and death. There is no use in making plans to get rid of these miseries of the material body. The best course is to find out the means by which one may regain his spiritual identity.
Mm. So it's not healthy to turn a blind eye to the to these realities. And these are subjects that most people don't want to talk about or think about or be reminded of, right? But the spiritual practitioner is actually eager to look at these things. And sometimes even, you know, one may be prescribed. You know, I've heard that in the olden days that sometimes for a disciple that was having especially difficulty with lust, you know, that the guru would order the disciple to spend some time at the funeral pyres, you know, and watch bodies being burned. You know, because it helps you become sober. And I know that when we went to Jagannath Puri, it was almost 2 years ago now, you know, we were with some young Japanese men and women. They weren't really devotees yet. They'd never been to India. And as we were walking past the Jagannath Temple on the way to the beach, we came to the Swarga Dora. So there's a place there right on the beach called the Swarga Dora. You know, Swarga means heaven, right? And Dora means gate, right? So the entrance to heaven. And what it was a burning god. And at one time, at any one moment, there was probably 12 to 14 bodies being burnt in different stages of being burnt. And this was a real shocker to actually even to seasoned devotees who's never seen such a thing. It might be quite a shocker. But it was very, very sobering and very, very purifying, really, to see that and contemplate that. That it's walking. And what is it called when you become temporarily renounced when somebody dies? Vaish says it all the time. There's a Sanskrit word, something chaga. What is it? Huh? Smashana vairagya, yeah. So we don't want to, what is smashana? That must be very temporary, huh? Oh, funeral? Yeah. Yeah. So we want our vairagya to be a little bit more than that. So we should eagerly discuss, you know, birth, death, old age, and disease, and look at, be willing to look it square in the eye.
I just remember when my mother was passing away in her last moments, my sister was also there and her kids were in the other room, but she called them, you know, into the room, and her reasoning behind that was, I want them to face death and to know about death. And they should be, yeah. Which was, you know, it was an eye-opener for me.
Wow, how wonderful. Jeez. What a great soul.
It says, the best course is to find out the means by which one may regain his spiritual identity. So this seems to be a profound statement. It seems to be a solution to how to overcome these four things, correct? Because earlier it is saying there is no use in making plans to get rid of these miseries of the material body.
Mm.
That is by directly addressing them, like improved medicine and all those types of things, prolonging aging and, you know, all that. Mm. That it says that that's not going to work. You should find another formula. And that formula must be going on a path of bhakti yoga. Correct? Prabhupada is implying, or the translation here is implying that that don't directly try to mitigate those four things, take on to another path and overcome them.
Yeah, because that will distract us. You know, we, instead of focusing on how to realize we're not this body, we'll spend all our time trying to prolong it and maintain our attachment to it. So just the opposite. Our focus and our energy will go into remaining ignorant. And it's not that we shouldn't take care of the body and do what we need to do, but ultimately, at the same time, we know that it's temporary and it's going to go, and there's only so much you can do. So our main focus should be on practices that help us understand that we're the knower of the field and not the field. And bhakti yoga is it's a comprehensive method, you know, because it brings us to the realization of not only that we're not the body, that we're the soul, but that we're the eternal servant of Krishna. So it's a complete realization. And so we don't even separately endeavor just to understand we're not the body. Because there are plenty of techniques and plenty of processes that one can perform. And one can get so absorbed in those that he'll forget about devotion and the process of devotion. So just, you know, by following actually the path that Prabhupada has given us, if we don't do it superficially, because we also should be asking, you know, we should be having this realization, and if we're not, after so many years, then we have to reevaluate our practice and see how we can go deeper. So we can't stay on the superficial level, you know, and not really be avoiding the 10 offenses in chanting and not really trying to go deeper, and then these realizations won't really come to us. So we have some hands up here. All right.
You mentioned about steadiness. So how do we... what was the point that you mentioned for being unsteady and, you know, how to improve your steadiness?
Well, Prabhupada said here, he said... in order to approach the platform of self-realization, one must fall... Oh, no, that wasn't it. But that's part of it. One should be fixed in the tenets. That's number 7, right? Or number 8. Yeah, one should be fixed in the tenets of the revealed scriptures. So that means that we should understand what the conclusion is, what the essential meaning is of the revealed scriptures. And we should know what they say. So we should know the Bhagavad Gita, and we should know what Krishna is recommending, just like what we're studying right now. What is the definition of knowledge? Well, Krishna said the definition of knowledge is to know that you're not the body. You're not the mind and you're not the body. If you know that, then you actually know something. And he says, if you don't know that, then you don't know anything. And so just hearing that is very purifying. And just focusing on that alone changes the whole dynamic of one's life and the whole priority of one's life. And so when we have that in the, you know, we have that as our goal, and we're meditating on Krishna's words, you know, that helps us become steady. Otherwise, our mind is jumping around. Oh, maybe I should do this, maybe I should do that, maybe I should do this path, maybe I should go listen over here, maybe I should... And you're just all over the place, so you're not steady. And then, you know, as we're advancing in Krishna consciousness, we go through a period of unsteadiness that may last a long time. And even that is explained in the scriptures. what that unsteadiness is, what are the causes of that unsteadiness, what are the different flavors of unsteadiness and their causes. If we know what they are, then we can avoid them, or we can see where we're at and make improvement. So in this way, Prabhupada says, if we know the tenets of the scriptures, then this will assist us in becoming steady. That's one way of
which book was mentioning about the, like, during the devotional service, there will be a time of unsteadiness?
Well, in the Madhurya Kadambini, Srila Visnu Chakravarti, he analyzes six stages of unsteadiness and six causes. I can't remember them off the top of my head. The first one is actually pride and becoming, learning the scripture and then becoming proud. And another one is not being able to make a firm decision and jumping around. And another one is not being able to maintain your vows or making a vow bigger than you can honestly do. And then there's two other ones. And then, of course, there's a nectar of devotion that describes, anartha nirviti and how one goes through that process. So if we know these things, at least theoretically, then we're more aware of them, and then we can look, and we have something to gauge, where we're at. And when we see where we're at, then we can see, where we go next on the path. It's like a map. If we have a map of where we are and where we're going, then it's easier to make decisions and to see where you have to go next. And also you can recognize, I'm still on the path. I'm over here, I'm right at the beginning, but there I am,
I just want to say something for the callers on the phone. If there are any callers on the phone, you can speak at any time by unmuting yourself. Press *6, and then after you speak, you again please mute by pressing *6.
Thank you for that announcement. What time is it? I can't see it. 5 minutes to 8? Oh, okay.
Here it says that the perception of evil, of birth and death, I could see that perception a lot because when I was growing up, on the other hand, in India they take dead bodies on that carrier along the streets, and if they hear, like, they come with drums and things like that. So my mom used to say, like, don't go. Wherever we are, she used to pull us inside and say, you should not see it, because that they think that's evil, like perception, like, mm-hmm. Don't see, don't talk about it. And even if you say death, or if I have to die, if you ask that question, they would say, no, you should not talk about it, because death is not good. So, and then Prabhupada is saying in that, the translation to that is saying, like, we must face the miseries. But we are told actually to turn away, and they used to somehow try and avoid it or hide it. So it's exactly opposite of what it is.
It's called the ostrich syndrome. So, shall we continue on? I'd like to finish this part. Where were we? Number 13, and in the Bhagavad Gita, that would be 13 is and how? Where is it in the Bhagavad Gita? Oh, detachment. Okay. So who's next up?
Detachment. One should not be attached to more than the necessities of life required for spiritual advancement.
Hmm. Any comment? Yeah? Yeah. Good. You know the Ishavasya verse? And the Isha Upanishad, yeah. So go ahead. What can you say about this point?
Well, this is very very easy to understand, hard to probably put in practice. Hmm. Every time there's a holiday, I can't resist going out shopping.
I gotta put a curve to that. Okay. Thanks. Now, Rakshit, you had some point about Ishavasya.
Yes, I just wanted to add that when it says that one should not be attached to more than the necessities of life, then there is this Ishavasya verse in the Upanishad which says that there is a quota for every person based on what they actually need, and one should be satisfied for that, knowing what their quota is and not going for something else that you know belongs to somebody else. Mm. May apply to us.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, now that we're reading these different explanations in the Upanishads, they're almost taken from some other part of what Prabhupada has already written somewhere else. And I'm thinking that Prabhupada's actually really thinking about this verse that you pointed out, Raksha Prabhu, as he wrote this. So next, we're on freedom from entanglement with children, which would be 14, huh? Who's next up? Who's going to hit a home run? Now, does Hari Guru Prabhu, is he authorized to read this one? Is he qualified?
Freedom from entanglement with children, wife, home, and the rest. And in the Upanishad it reads, one should not be more attached to wife, children, and home than the revealed scriptures ordain.
Mm. So, any comments?
Just a few days ago, I was listening to this pastime of Vamandev. Mm. And in that, Bali Maharaj has a verse to share. And he quotes Prahlad Maharaj. And he says that these relatives, wives, children, and all are like thieves.
You're brutal.
So, and he says they're only there to divert our attention from the real goal of life. That's the only purpose to do. So,
Jai. That's pretty heavy. I have to think about that one. Rishabhdev, he says some pretty heavy things too, and so does Kapila Dev. One shouldn't become a dancing dog and jackals and all kinds of things. So what are we on next? In the Bhagavad Gita we're reading evenness of mind, huh? And that's which number? 15? Okay. Page 71 in the Upanishad.
One should not be happy or distressed over desirable and undesirables, knowing that such feelings are just created by the mind.
Wow. So evenness of mind, Prabhupada says, one should not be happy or distressed over desirables and undesirables, knowing that such feelings are just created by the mind. Any comments?
All this happiness and distress, what we are feeling, it's in level of mind, not it's not beyond. So It's not eternal also.
Just the contents of mind. Huh?
Yeah, it's just mental speculation.
Just thoughts appearing in the mind. Now, when you hear this phrase here in the Isha Upanishad, does it remind you of anything else where Prabhupada has, or Krishna has said almost this exact thing? You know? Matra Sparsha Stakanta, yeah. Yeah, Prabhupada says that Krishna says that the happiness and distress is due to sense perception. And then in the other verse he says prajahati yada kaman sarvan partha manogatan. Manogatan means mental speculation or mental concoction, that the desires, the things we're wanting that we think are so important in this world, are just thoughts that are appearing in the mind, you know, and at one moment we may want them and the next day we may not want them. A different thought will be there. But it's all being generated in the mind. So, yeah.
Generally, our mind is so weak that even when we are watching a movie, if the scene is very pleasant, then at least I become happy. Or if the scene is creating, sometimes in some scenes create unhappiness. So everything is a drama out there, and we know that still mind experiences happiness or distress because of what we are seeing on the screen.
Yeah, yeah, our own screen, right? We're watching our own movie.
People realize their TV is not the bodies. They have to come to platform of body, then we can preach devotee smriti. They won't realize us. They realize themselves as TV. They cry, the TV cries.
Actually, if you can realize that you're watching your own movie, that's quite a big step. That's a big step forward. That's real knowledge. Yeah. But the TV and the movie is the excellent example, because that's just as true. The same process of forgetting oneself and identifying is exactly the same.
So Prabhuji, should we be consciously practicing that you know, if I have a thought that comes to my mind, to think that see, here's a thought, and now the second is being generated from there, and consciously thinking that I'm not the body? Or is it something that happens just by following the path of devotional service? Or is it both? And the reason I'm asking is because I come from a family of monoists, and they kind of taught me to meditate that way, that, you know, you sit down and then you try to get out of your body and turn around and see that you're not the body, the body is left over there. And so should we be doing something like that? Or should we just be chanting and that will lead to the same result?
Well, Krishna says that if you're going to do something, if you do it in not... He says this in the fourth chapter. He says that really higher than karma is jnana. So if you're doing some activity, but you're not consciously doing it, you get a result. If you're doing a good activity, you get a good result. But if you're doing it in knowledge, you get a much higher result. So I think what your parents were teaching you is correct, that whatever we're doing, we should do it in full Krishna consciousness, Prabhupada likes to say. I mean, we should do it in full awareness. We should practice awareness and being aware. But awareness without devotion ultimately doesn't mean that much. So as long as it's connected with Krishna, so... Yeah, we should be. We shouldn't just let the thoughts in our mind run wild and do whatever they want. Then our mind becomes our enemy. But if we are aware of the contents of mind, then automatically a higher level of awareness is activated. So as soon as you're aware of something, you're no longer identified with it. So the problem is when we watch the movie, we forget ourselves. And then we experience the contents of the movie. So that's the problem's not the movie. The problem is our identification with it. And so, yes, I think that whatever we're doing on all our activities in Krishna consciousness, so we should do it with full awareness as much as we can. And if we forget to become aware, then immediately, as soon as we forget and we realize I haven't been aware, then we're aware again at that moment. And so it's a cultivation. And I think that's the shortcut. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then again, you can only do that when you can do that, and when you become aware of it, or when someone points it out to you. Sometimes people, you know, devotees point things out to us, Prabhupada points things out to us over and over again, right? But it doesn't click. And then one day it clicks. And then we know it, and then, so I think it's like that. So how many, we got a couple more to go here, right? We're on, which one? We're on 17? 16, huh? 16. So in the Bhagavad Gita it says, constant and unalloyed devotion to me. And in the Ishopanishad,
one should become an unalloyed devotee of the personality of Godhead Shri Krishna and serve him with rapt attention.
Rapt attention. I like that word. So if we don't know where our attention is, it's not going to be very rapt. Okay. And then number 17 would be aspiring to live in a solitary place.
Yes, aspiring to live in a solitary place. One should develop a liking for residence in a secluded place with a calm and quiet atmosphere, favorable for spiritual culture, and one should avoid congested places where non-devotees congregate.
Like the shopping mall? Okay, and number 18, detachment from the general mass of people, accepting the importance of self-realization and philosophical search for the absolute truth, all these I declare to be knowledge, and besides this, whatever there is, whatever there may be is ignorance. And so in Ishopanishad we have number 18.
One should become a scientist or philosopher and conduct research into spiritual knowledge, recognizing that spiritual knowledge is permanent, whereas material knowledge ends with the death of the body.
Mm. Jai. So what we did here tonight is in verses 8 through 12 in chapter 13 of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains the process of knowledge, and Prabhupada makes the same points in his purport of mantra 10 in Ishopanishad, because this mantra says, the wise have explained that one result is derived from the culture of knowledge and that a different result is obtained from the culture of nescience. So Prabhupada begins the purport by defining what is knowledge and what is the process of realizing that knowledge. So the process of realizing knowledge is to follow these 18 points. And what is knowledge? Krishna defines knowledge because Arjuna asked him, what is knowledge? And Krishna replied, to know the knower of this body, to know what the field is, and to know the knower of the field, and to know the difference, and to also know the knower in all bodies or all fields. He says that is knowledge. And so how do we come to realize that we're the knower of the field and we're not the field? By cultivating these 18 aspects of knowledge. And of all these 18 aspects of knowledge, what is the most important? Microphone.
It would be unalloyed devotional service to the Lord, because all good things would come from it.
Yeah. And if we're not an unalloyed devotee of the Lord and we have everything else?
What is that? There was a quote that was cited that what good would it do if you gained the world and lost yourself?
Right. It's in the Bible, yeah. What does a man profit if he gains the whole world but he loses his soul? So you can't take it with you. So next week we'll finish this purport in Ishopanishad, and maybe we'll even finish this purport in the Bhagavad Gita. It's possible. So any last closing comments or questions before we finish tonight? Okay. So all glories to Ishopanishads and to Bhagavad Gita and to Srila Prabhupada. Hare Krishna.